But yeah, went on the Ramsey show and was able to really use that in that when I was working with people through that financial education program, because I said, look, I wasn't just handed money in my bank account. I'm like, hey, I know where you're at. I've been there. I've been on the other side of this. There's a way through this.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Stephen Newland from MoneyPath, another fractional CFO. And before we get into it, Stephen, I'll tell you, a couple of weeks ago, I sent my dad to Nepal on a holiday. I offered him a holiday. I was expecting him to say Cork or somewhere else in Ireland, and he said Nepal. I couldn't believe it. So I sent him, and he made it. But I have to admit, he's getting on, and I was thinking, geez, what if I have to fly him home in a box? That would be terrible. And I was wondering, God, that's terrible. It'd be probably pretty expensive. So you're a man who actually flew a lot of bodies around the place in earlier on in your career. So if you also have ever wondered what it would be like or how much it would cost to fly a relative across the world, should the worst happen, this is the podcast for you, which I think is the most unusual intro I've managed to do so far. So Stephen, kick us off. Tell us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here today. And I guess the thing that I usually kind of lead with, what's like kind of the fun fact, is I've been to 38 countries. So yeah, that's my fun fact. And most of that, I would say between the ages of 20 and 27.
Okay, 20 and 27. Wow, okay, yeah. Okay, well, you and I could duke it out. I don't know if I've been to 38, but I've been to a fair few. Where's your favorite spot?
Yeah, my favorite trip, there were about four or five of us, maybe more of us. We were all in our early mid-20s. We took a trip to Jerusalem, and it just happened to be, I don't think we actually planned this, because, you know, who plans when you're in your early 20s with a group of guys and you're just, you know, taking a trip somewhere? I went to Jerusalem and slept we got like a hostel, and we actually got to sleep on the roof, and we could see the gold dome. It was really cool. It was just a really cool experience.
Yeah, like nowhere else in the world. There's a movie called Life of Brian. You may not have seen it, but it's set in biblical times, so it's a rather irreverent sort of funny movie. But anyway, it's all higgledy-piggledy streets, and it's all crowded, and it's just like you think it would be in the movies. It's an incredible city. Cool. So all that travel, do you think that gives you an edge in your day to day as a fractional CFO?
I do. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't know that I would have put this together even just a few years ago, but just seeing different perspectives and just seeing how different parts of the world operate and, you know, different approaches to business, different approaches to culture and life. I think that just kind of broadened my perspective. And, you know, I think that's a critical element to any successful fractional CFO, is you're constantly analyzing and, you know, you're trying to think of new ideas and, you know, hey, how can we deploy this capital, or how can we get creative with, you know, paying down debt or whatever that looks like. So I just think it gave me a different perspective. And also, so especially around that, but also problem solving. If you've ever traveled and gone on, you know, different metro systems and you're trying to find something and you can't speak the language, and you're like, okay, my solution A didn't work. Let's go to B and then maybe C. And then you have to get kind of out of your comfort zone. So I'd say that's another way.
Yeah, I feel like I'm a good few years older than you, I'd say. But I stayed in Israel in a kibbutz when I was 18 or 19. I was chasing a girl. That's a different story. It didn't work out so well. But anyway, once a week, I would organize a time to call my parents at home. You know, like we knew, okay, you be home and I'll call from a payphone. And we could afford, I think, maybe once a month. These days, I feel like the kids have it too easy. You get out your phone, you got your Gmail, you got your Google Translate. I went to Japan last year. It was fine. You could do everything. Like I could, you know. So, you know, you and me were traveling when it was at least a bit more challenging, to say.
There was an app that came out. I think it was Google. This was towards kind of the end when I was doing a lot of my traveling, but where you could like hold your camera up, pointed at a sign and like the Tokyo Metro, and it would translate it to like, here's what it said in English, if they didn't have like an English subtitle underneath it. Problem was, you needed internet, you needed Wi-Fi, and we never had that, you know. So anyway, but that was towards the end of my, so I traveled on hard mode is what I'll say.
Good. I'm glad you got that. So, okay. So listen, not everyone gets to be on the Gross Profit podcast. We better set out your credibility here. Tell us a little bit about how you got started in finance and where you've ended up.
Yeah, I'll kind of go through it high level and then I'm sure we'll dive a little deeper. You know, I started off as an intern in school, in college. I actually interned with Delta Airlines and they kind of threw me right in, which was awesome. That's what I was hoping for. So they threw me right in. I ended up getting a full-time offer and went into corporate finance with them right out of school, worked with them for a number of years in different analyst roles and finance roles. And then I took a complete left turn and went to help run a financial education program for about 6 years at a pretty large church here. I'm in Atlanta. And, you know, that was very interesting because it gave me a different perspective on budgeting. I got to sit across from people and hear how they made budgeting decisions, which might feel different than corporate finance, but all budget decisions in corporate finance are handled by people. And so I really understood I got to understand the psychology behind money and how people think about money. So,
all right, well, we'll get onto that in a second, but I can't let you gloss over this thing I teased at the top of the show, which is, you know, you had an interesting job, which was you were responsible for pricing at Delta, which is very interesting, a particular very specific product. If you can tell us what that product was and how does effectively a kid get the responsibility of pricing this thing for a massive company like that?
Yeah. So the product, probably the marketing team could, and hope maybe they've rebranded by now. The product was called Human Remains. So, you know, it just is what it is, as you can only imagine. And I actually was an intern. They gave me this project and they said, hey, we need to revisit our pricing on, I was in Delta Cargo at the time. So I was interning in cargo. Cargo is essentially everything underneath that plane. So you think about all the space above the plane. Well, the bags only take up a very small portion of what's under the plane. There's a lot of space in there and there's a lot of stuff flying underneath that plane that you don't even think about. And so, yeah, so they gave me this and said, hey, we got to figure out, you know, if our pricing's competitive. So go look at other airlines, go see how they're pricing their human remains product. And so I did that and made some suggestions and on some pricing changes. And that was as an intern in college.
Wow. Amazing. And I have to ask, obviously, you know, with your sort of, let me think of the right word here. You're sort of, we already know that you went to work for a church and you've got this sort of, you're looking for do good in the world. When a company like that is looking at a product like that, is it still cold, hard dollars they're looking at, or is there a PR aspect to this? Because I imagine in a situation like that, it's highly leveraged. You're, you know, it's often a tragic situation. What was the approach taken? Is this, when they said it wanted to revisit pricing, was it a view to maximizing pricing, or is there a strong, how much does the PR or the sort of wider good feed into how you decide to price a product like that?
Yeah, really good question. My recollection of my experience was simply numbers on a spreadsheet. If, you know, United Airlines is pricing it this, we've got to either come up to that pricing, or maybe we need to, you know, we feel comfortable maybe pricing as a premium on that. So that was my experience. Now at a higher level, as the decisions were being made, maybe that came in to play, but for my part of it, it was purely, you know, I should caveat that with the intent wasn't to price gouge. It was more to like, hey, let's make sure we're covering our cost, especially in cargo, because there's opportunity cost of, you know, a casket is not a small item that could fit a couple pallets or a pallet or two of other goods that you could get more of a premium for. And so that was a lot of the analysis that we would look at. Yeah.
Very good. Okay. So if I pop my clog somewhere, I can't book first class in a casket, right? It's just all the same. I'm in there with all the chickens and whatever else they got. Okay.
That seems like right.
Okay, cool. So now you touched on this, which is very interesting. Before we get into your careers, your experience working in a church, but this wasn't internally in the finance function, but you were working with the parishioners. Is that how you describe it? Tell me a little bit about what you did in that role. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, they had a program set up, it's like a financial education, financial literacy program through the church. And my full-time role was there to just meet with people, go through their budgets with them. And also we had a mentoring program as well. So we would pair them up with a volunteer mentor that, you know, I'd have to vet them and make sure that they're kind of up to speed on everything. And yeah, but I got to sit with every single person that went through the mentoring program. I'd sat down for an hour and talk through their budget, talk through, you know, the stuff outside of the numbers. You know, how did you get to this position? How did you get all the debt. Why do you want to pay this off? And so that's where I talked about a little bit of that psychology behind money. I learned a lot about the motivations and how people think about money through that experience.
So when you say learn about, what was your biggest takeaway? What's the thing that strikes you when you think back to that time?
Yeah, my first approach when I came into this. So my background obviously was working for Delta and doing a lot of analysis. My first approach was, this is all just numbers on paper. So let's just focus on the numbers side of things. I quickly realized that was very wrong. And money is way more emotional and way more kind of soft than it is about the hard numbers. And I think that was a skill set I just didn't have. I didn't really recognize that. And so, yeah, I was able to learn that very quickly. And you can then adapt that to corporate finance, because if you're dealing with a business owner, and this is very personal to them, because if they hit a profit this year, that might mean, you know, a new vacation for their family or a new car for their family or, you know, whatever that is. This is very personal to them. And so, yes, you still have to focus on the numbers aspect of it. But if you can bring in some of that softer kind of communication and understand, like, hey, this is what that business owner is thinking when you're working with them. It's not just, hey, you missed your numbers, but it's, you know, so that's really what opened my eyes to that perspective.
Interesting. So yeah, okay. So it must have been pretty to turn around to work from out of the accounts department into dealing with God knows what sort of situation. It was quite a turnaround. So Dave Ramsey is the big guy in that, big dog in that space. Did you guys engage, or what do you think of his sort of approach, given that you've seen people from all walks of life sort of trying to deal with their finances in the church?
It's funny, I've defended Ramsey on like every point. And then I've like also had other elements where I'm like, I don't know if I fully agree here. My initial take is he's having to broadcast and he's having to put out a framework for the masses. And so, you know, I think all financial advice or a lot of there's financial principles, but then there's like specific actions that everybody can take. And I think there are some certain circumstances where, you know, there's nuance involved. And
So the famous one, he's no debt at any cost, right? All debt is bad. And right. Do you agree with that? Or is that one of the ones you're like, not all debt can be bad?
I mean, the way I think about it is debt on something, on an asset that's not appreciating in value. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's bad debt. So, you know, if you think about like a car, things like that. So those are depreciating in value pretty quickly. And so, but you know, for me, if I hadn't, there might have been ways for me to fund school without debt. Probably could have, but I was in a tougher situation at the time, family and personal stuff. And so I was able to leverage that debt to then get a higher paying job. So, I mean, that for me worked out well, but I've seen it also go very poorly where people get way too much debt, $200,000-$300,000 in debt from school. And that creates a real big hurdle. So,
okay. Well, not just walking the walk, but you've walked the walk here, because you actually ended up as Dave Ramsey on the Dave Ramsey show. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you end up there? What were you doing?
Yeah. So the impetus for me switching from Delta to this program was so I was at Delta full time for 4 years. I was an intern for a couple of years before that. During my full time at Delta, I had been kind of working the Ramsey plan. And I had paid off, I think I had close to $55,000 of debt, and I paid that off in 4 years. And I just wanted to go help other people do the same thing. You know, I wasn't making huge money. It was an entry level job out of school. I was traveling a lot. And so I was spending a lot of money on travel, but it was just trying to be diligent. And, you know, I thought, hey, if I could do this with, you know, a reasonable income, then somebody else can do this. And I want to help other people kind of get rid of that weight that I felt every single day with that debt. And so, yeah, went on the Ramsey show and was able to really use that in that when I was working with people through that financial education program, because I said, look, I wasn't just handed like, you know, money in my bank account. I'm like, hey, I've been through, I know where you're at. I've been there. I've been on the other side of this. You know, there's a way through this. So.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So you've got the sort of the numbers, you got that sort of empathy. I'm hearing a lot of empathy in what you're saying. And obviously, you know, walking away from Delta, that's a career that could have been set for life. And to make that choice, I have to admire. Your first CFO client or fractional CFO client, was it Gravy? Because we get back in, maybe you can just explain a bit about what Gravy is or was and what your role was.
So, So when I was at that program, running the financial education program, I just had this itch. I really missed business. I really wanted to get back into the business world. So I enjoyed my time there, but I really just missed that aspect of it. So I actually went and worked for helped a fintech here in Atlanta raise their first $1 million seed round. And helped them raise that. It was a very small team, but I was overseeing the finance side of things. And then I did that for a little bit. And then there was another company, Gravy, who they had just raised a Series A, and they were looking for their first finance hire, they were looking for another finance leader to come in and help, you know, manage the forecast and just kind of manage all things finance. So,
when you got there with there, so for Series A, that's the stage where you're basically professionalizing, I guess. And was the name of that game getting to Series B on, or were they focused on profitability? And what did you do? What was the first thing you did to try and get them to that professional level?
Yeah, I mean, one of the very first things I came in and did was build a cash flow forecast. They didn't have a great one in place, and especially one that was being updated regularly. And so I built that infrastructure out, built out some leadership reporting to give them visibility into, hey, here's where cash is headed. And if, you know, especially if anyone's worked at a startup, you know, cash burn is very high, especially right after a raise, or it can be high. And so there's a lot of dollars going out the door. And back to the psychology side of things, when the leadership team sees, hey, our payroll just doubled and there's a lot more money going out the door every month, that does something to them. And so having that clarity and reporting easily accessible, you know, it helps manage them, helps them manage that mental load. But yeah.
So I have a tactical question here. When you're doing a forecast like that, some people roll, so they add a month on every month, you know, and you keep going that way. But I can see that being kind of a very speculative, because 12 months is a long way, especially in a company like that. What's your approach? What's the Goldilocks zone for updating your cash flow? Not weekly, not yearly, but it's got to be something in between, right?
Yeah, my overarching, you know, kind of principle there is I typically do the rolling to give a rolling 12 month. I would say for the most part, though, a lot of those out months, so let's call it months 6 through 12, a lot of those are just kind of driven off of, hey, what are the actuals saying, or any like tweaks to assumptions in maybe the next 3 months. So, you know, I might go in and tweak assumptions a little bit more dialed in, you know, for the next 3 months. And then the outer months are just kind of more driven off of high level drivers, I'd say. So
okay, yes.
It's directional. Are we going to run out of cash or not?
Yeah. Okay. So it's less, I had it in my mind, it was like you add an extra month, but it's actually you revise the whole thing every quarter, tweaking, there's a new reality here. So sales weren't what they were expected, or they're more than we expected, et cetera. What are we going to do on the back of that? Okay.
Yeah. And it's usually pretty simple. There's usually, at least there should be, it's understanding. I think the key here is understanding what are the key levers in the organization. You know, there might be a handful of inputs on the sales side. You know, what's the hiring plan look like? Because that's usually one of the biggest costs to most organizations. So just updating not every single assumption, but maybe updating those 4, 5, 6 assumptions that are really going to drive the forecast.
All right, good. So, okay, so from Gravy then, you sort of took a step. You went from commercial to nonprofit, and then you're like, no, yeah, I don't want this. And then you sort of pivoted it back again. So you've sort of a little bit of a flip-flop in your career going on here. But yeah, next,
I do. And I think I finally landed where I'm supposed to be. Okay. After Gravy,
next year.
Yeah, that's exactly right. After Gravy, I went and helped run FP&A team at a fractional CFO firm. And so I helped, you know, I had some fractional CFO clients. We had, at any given time, we might've had 20 to 25 clients. And there's a team of analysts that I had there. And yeah, so we were essentially just jumping in. And so this was my first foray into managing a portfolio versus managing, like, being in-house, having one person or one organization to work with. So that really showed me quite a bit about the fractional CFO business.
Okay, very good. And then you were involved there with them. They had a sort of a bent towards grant management or a little bit. Am I wrong? Were you first exposed to fund accounting?
They did quite a bit on startups and small businesses. Yeah, what I haven't really talked about is kind of on the background here, I always was involved in nonprofit like in the background, even when I was at the church, even when I was at Delta. So I was treasurer for a local nonprofit for a while, and I helped kind of run day to day for a very small startup, or a very small nonprofit here. They were doing like 100 to 125,000 a year running finance for them. So I had always kind of been exposed to it in the, on the back end.
So when it comes to these organizations, you know, they might not have revenue aside from whatever contract they have from the government or a grant from a benevolent organization. Mm-hmm. What are the things that you have to do differently compared to a purely commercial organization to make this work, if you like?
Yeah. I mean, one, so an organization, so after I left that fractional CFO firm, I went and helped become the finance lead for a fast growing foster care nonprofit here in Atlanta, as well as started my own company focused on nonprofit. One thing that, you know, you learn through that is there are a lot of different ways you can raise money. You can do golf tournaments, you can do galas, you can talk with major donors, you can do grants, you can even have earned revenue. So that's been becoming a very popular, you know, avenue to raise money for nonprofits, where it's like you're actually signing contracts and providing the service for people. So every organization is a little bit different. Every organization, just like a company, right? I mean, some causes are way easier if they're kind of in the ecosystem of culture. You know, kind of like floating down the river of wherever culture is going right now, it's a lot easier to raise grant money because everyone wants to be tied to, you know, whatever that cause is. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example. Like, I'm working with an organization now focused on mental health, and especially mental health when it comes to social media. So that is a huge topic. And there are actually like grantors and grants approaching them versus them having to go like seek it out. Wow. And so, yeah, so that's just every organization is a little bit different, and it's just trying to tap in and trying to figure out, where does my cause fit? What's going to be the easiest way to raise money for my cause?
Very good. So what's your chef's kiss, like perfect customer to work with, if you like, today in your fractional? So tell us a little bit more where you're based. Is your geographic base to your customer base? What sort of customer should reach out if they hear this?
Yeah, I'm in Atlanta myself, but I work with nonprofits all over the country, all over the United States. I have worked with nonprofits and organizations overseas, but I would say for nonprofit, I'm more focused on the States, but doesn't necessarily have to be just Georgia. But yeah, typically it's about 1 million to 10 million in revenue. And I would even say maybe even a little bit lower than that. You could even go somewhere between 5 and 7 million in revenue. After that, they typically are going to hire someone in-house. Hmm. And it's really just, it's very similar to the startup world. It's that organization who feels like, okay, this is getting bigger and bigger, and I'm seeing more money go out every single month. I feel like I'm losing, you know, clarity. I don't have the confidence in everything anymore, and I feel like I'm losing a little bit of control. And so it's someone who feels like they're a little bit operating out of their zone of genius, and they want someone, the executive director wants an expert to come in and not have to worry about the financial side of the organization.
Yeah, okay. And the stakeholders involved, is there a difference in sort of the reporting you have to do? So, you know, I guess in a commercial organization, you have your tax accounting, you know, you got sometimes your management accounting, but is there any other reports that you wouldn't have in a traditional organization that you need to be able to produce, and how would you go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, you'll have, depending on if you're funding your organization through grants, every grant, or not every grant, but some grants could ask for, you know, hey, we need monthly or quarterly reporting, or even annual reporting. The tax forms are certainly different. So you've got a form 990, which is largely an informational tax return. I think what they're doing with that is they're trying to match it up to some deductions on personal and corporate returns to make sure that what is being reported over here is tying to like what, you know, the nonprofit is reporting. But those are kind of the two differences. But largely, you know, I would say there are little tweaks and differences, but the financial principles that you apply to startups or small businesses, I would say it's 90 to 95% the exact same. And there's maybe on the edges a little bit, there's some nuance and a little bit of different, but for the most part, it's very similar.
Cool. Stephen, so how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah. So moneypathfpa.com is my website. I've got a bunch of resources on there. You know, if you know any nonprofits or you're on the board of any nonprofits, I've got a list of 150 nonprofit discounts, cash flow template, got just a handful of resources on there to help nonprofits navigate, you know, finances for their organization.
That's very good. You sent me that as well, and I recommend it. It looks like a great resource. Well done for putting that together. Thanks very much. And thank you for listening this far. If you're still listening, congratulations. Your special reward for staying here with me and Stephen is to be able to sign up for our newsletter. Now, I know what you're thinking, Stephen. Why would I want to sign up for your newsletter? So let me give you a few good reasons. Newsletter is something we've worked really hard on. And what we figured out is that we put examples of recent financial missteps that have been reported in the news into the newsletter. It does two things. One, it gives you a heads up on some mistakes that people can make. Sometimes these mistakes end up putting them in a bit of hot water or to a lot of hot water. It might be even jail time involved. So we can all learn from that. And the second reason is, let's face it, it's also fairly entertaining to figure out how some people mess up so badly sometimes. And you can, even the likes of Naomi Campbell has ended up in our newsletter for not properly administering the charity that she set up. So for entertainment, interest, and also to make sure you don't end up in our newsletter, I recommend you sign up at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You also get invites into our exclusive mastermind for niche finance topics like education, grant management, and fractional CFOs. And then, of course, if that wasn't enough, you also get to keep up to date with podcasts like episodes like this that are coming out on the weekly. So thanks very much. And that's it. Thanks, Stephen. I really enjoyed chatting.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.